Hello, this is Jill Pasternak. Welcome to Crossover, the program that explores the universal language, music. We've just heard the Tango in Blue, written in 2001, by our guest today, José Serebrière, the celebrated conductor with whom I had the pleasure of speaking, really, about an amazing career. He was, of course, a graduate of Curtis, and we spoke with him in detail because of a wonderful new release that he has out of the Dvorak symphonies.
Hello, Jill.
Yes, hi.
Hi, good morning.
So this is Maestro Serebrière?
Yes.
Oh,
yes,
you know, morning. I have to tell you, I was nervous to speak with you because being on the radio, all you see with these CDs and recordings is José Serebrière.
Oh,
and I tell you, it's a little bit intimidating. I'm thrilled to have the opportunity to speak with you.
Fantastic.
And as a harpist, I guess I'm starting at the kind of the end, not the beginning here, but I was so fascinated that you had written a concerto for harp and orchestra initially many years ago. Is that right?
Absolutely. It was commissioned by Samuel Rosenbaum, who used to be the chairman of the Philadelphia Orchestra a long time ago, for his wife, who used to be the harpist, famous harpist of the Philadelphia Orchestra for many years. He commissioned two concertos, the famous one by Gina Stera and mine.
Oh, yes.
Mine is called Magic Colors.
Yes, but it was...
Color.
Yes, they said that it was for the Joffrey Ballet, is that right?
No, the Joffrey Ballet liked it and adopted it as a ballet. It was written... it was premiered by Heidi Lewalder, a fantastic harpist.
Of course, yes.
And then the New York premiere was done by Nancy Allen.
Oh, yes, he's excellent. I think she's had him Julia.
She did about 100 performances of it on tour with the Joffrey Ballet. The Joffrey Ballet adopted it,
yes,
and converted it into a ballet. But they said it was too short at 12 minutes. Asked me if I could enlarge it. So it will be one segment.
I see.
But very difficult to make a 12-minute piece into a 24-minute, but I did it.
Well, now, what made you, I'm going to ask you more about, what fascinated you about writing for harp? It's a very different instrument than a lot of people realize.
Very different. Edna Phillips was the harpist who inspired it. She invited me to her house to play for me, to asked me if I would consider writing a harp concerto because they had heard my music while I was a student at Curtis Institute in Philadelphia.
Yes.
And I said no, for the reason you just gave. I said the harp is a very special instrument, like the guitar especially, but even more so the harp. I have to know the harp intimately in order to be able to write a concerto. So I turned it down. She didn't give up. She said, well, come back to my house and listen to five young harpists besides myself, one after the other. And I still said no. Until
especially after hearing five, I guess.
Can you imagine? I tell you quickly what happened. I went to Cleveland, invited by George Zell.
Yes, of
course. Composer in residence, yes, of the Cleveland Orchestra.
Yeah.
And the music critic wrote an editorial of 2 months after I arrived, huge whole page saying, instead of sitting in town composing music, José Serebrière is going all over the world conducting the major orchestras. I didn't know whether to be flattered or
well,
upset.
Well, everything. I mean, you've really done it all.
Well, but she thought I should stay in town composing. So I thought I better do it. And just that day, a bass player in the Cleveland Orchestra told me, you must come and look at this magnificent invention by a an Ohio resident who is a professional inventor. And his latest invention is a machine that translates sounds into images. So I loved it. I went there, and he played parts of Holst's The Planets.
Oh,
and I couldn't believe
my
what I saw. The images suddenly took life. And I thought, what instrument would be best to create images? And we played in front of this inventor several instruments from recordings, and the one that did the best in creating images was the harp.
There's lots of tattoo harps in there, yeah.
So I thought, fantastic, I will write a concerto for harp now with this instrument in mind. So that's why the piece is called Magic Colors, Colores Mágicos
yes.
in Spanish.
Yes, yes.
And the premiere in Washington, which was done by Heidi Livalder, we had her in a white suit, and we projected images on her and on a screen behind her, and the orchestra in the pit. And that's how the piece was conceived. But since then, it's been done many times without the images, just as a straight concerto.
Well, you know, we can always use more repertoire for harp.
Yes.
But I remember they used to, they had a little funny little cartoon showing a harpist, and they said a harpist has to have lots of pluck, a black silk costume, and a truck. Which is
I love it.
And actually, anyway, of course, you know, we're dragging this thing around, and it is a really an amazing instrument, I must say. But it is complex.
It is very difficult. I mean, fantastic instrument. And I had written many little segments of harp in my orchestral pieces, but harp concerto was very special. So it is the only work of mine that has not been recorded yet. So I am recording it this year in November in Turkey. With an orchestra called the Bilkent Symphony Orchestra. Uh-huh. Anyway, that's in the plans.
Oh, that's amazing. But I have to tell you, this, of course, being on the air and having all of our collection here at WRTI of recordings, your name is constantly coming up. And how many recordings have you done? I mean, you've had all kinds of Grammy Awards, but I mean, You're a composer first? Is that really how it started? I mean, is that what you really wanted to do?
No. I started as a composer because I wanted to conduct. When I was 14, and I wanted to conduct the National Symphony in Uruguay, where I was born.
Right.
And they said, forget it. You're 14. You have to. We don't have 14-year-old conductors. Then they had a composition contest. And I thought, wow, if I win it, maybe they let me conduct my piece. So I wrote this piece called The Legend of Faust, based on Thomas Mann's Legend of Faust. And I won the competition, although they only gave us 2 weeks' notice. I worked day and night, in fact, 5 days and five nights without sleep. My mother couldn't believe it because, you know, I couldn't do it anymore. And then I finished the piece on a taxi on the way to take the score on the deadline to be submitted. And I was more surprised than anybody when I won the competition, but they wouldn't let me conduct it. They gave it to a real professional conductor who later on became one of my teachers, Eleazar de Carvalho. Oh. He was also the teacher of Seiji Ozawa and Claudio Abbado and Zubin Mehta and almost everybody.
All of the big
generation.
Ones, yeah, right.
Yeah,
right.
He was older at Tanglewood. Eleazar de Carvalho, a marvelous teacher originally from Brazil. Mm-hmm. But so which was first, composition or conducting? I don't know. I wrote that piece because I wanted to conduct. I get musical satisfaction from both. But, you know, I never conduct my own compositions in concerts, if I can help it.
I think it's too close to you, probably.
That's too personal. It's like I'm standing naked in the
choir. Yeah.
But there is another more important reason. There is so little space for contemporary new music in concerts these days. If I put my own piece, I feel I'm taking the space from one of my colleagues.
Well, I don't think you're right, because I think you are you're so well known and you're so admired, and it's very exciting to be so terribly talented. I mean, you are, of course, you've reached the heights with conducting, but as a musician, as a composer, this, of course, is a whole, that's who you are, essentially. I think I guess conducting is kind of second to you. Here now, a work by José Cerebrier, his violin concerto, Winter, performed by Philippe Quint, violinist with the Bournemouth Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Maestro Cerebrier. Music of José Serebrière. We've just heard his violin concerto Winter, performed by violinist Philippe Quint, with the Bournemouth Symphony Orchestra conducted by Maestro Serebrière. Have you done anything recently at all in all the time that you don't have?
No. I wrote a flute concerto. It's called, the complete title is Flute Concerto with Tango.
Oh, my goodness.
There are so many flute concertos. I thought adding the word with tango made it special.
Well, I have to tell you, I am a tango file. I mean, I am crazy about tango. And so you love harp and you love tango. Well, I don't know. This
that
interview was destined, absolutely. But, oh, my goodness. Tell us a little bit about that. Oh, that sounds fantastic.
Yeah. Well, that piece is my latest piece. And it was recorded by a great flute player for whom I wrote it, Sharon Bezali. It was commissioned by Bees Records from Sweden.
Mm-hmm.
And they commissioned it for her. And it was recorded without my participation. It was recorded by her and the Australian Chamber Orchestra just a year ago or so, 2 years ago. And it's a fantastic performance. She's one of the greatest flutists ever. And the Australian Chamber Orchestra is unbelievable.
Yes.
So the record is spectacular.
Will that be coming out?
And it just came out. Yeah,
okay.
The recording is called something else, Pipe Dreams, because one of the pieces is called Pipe Dreams and it makes a good title.
Yes, yeah.
And I did the New York premiere. I conducted that with Sharon Bezali as soloist just last October at Carnegie Hall with the American Composers Orchestra.
Yes.
And it's a very success piece. I mean, the public, every time we play it, and since then I've done it many times with her, in Miami, Mexico, and so on. She's playing it today, in fact, in France. Every time the public can't resist but to applaud between movements at the end of each movement. It's such a virtuoso piece for the flutist that the public can't believe it.
But tell me about the tango, comes from.
One movement, sure. The fourth, there are five movements, and the fourth movement is called Unfinished Tango. And it fits perfectly, and it's like a respite. All the movements are virtuoso, flashy playing, where the flutist has to have an unbelievable technique. But the tango is the one which just brings you back to earth in a way. And I leave it unfinished. I literally stops in the middle. All tangos, the real tangos, stop in the dominant without going to the final note, the tonic. The tonic, you can almost hear it but not really.
They leave you, yes, they leave you.
So I did it in my piece. I went a step further. I really stopped in the middle of a phrase, but it's an ending. And then it goes straight into the finale, which is a race. Who goes faster, the orchestra or the flute?
But the whole idea of tango is really amazing. It's one of
The way I feel about composition, really, is that it helps my conducting. It's not modesty. I really feel that because I'm a composer, it means that I can look at the new score and eventually make it my own. I can see why the composer did this, why he did that, why he orchestrated it this way, why he phrased it this way. I think if there is any secret to my conducting, there is not. But if there is one, it's because I'm a composer and I can see the music from the inside out.
We've just heard Casi un Tango, which translates to Almost a Tango, written by José Serebrière in 2002. with the Bournemouth Symphony Orchestra, Maestro Serebrier conducting. You were first a composer, really.
That's right.
And then you searched for the right way of expressing your compositions, and then, of course, you became a conductor. But I just have to tell you, you're everywhere. I mean, and we admire you so very much, and it is
Thank
wonderful
you so much.
To speak with you about this.
Well, let me say something about my relationship with Philadelphia. May I do that?
Of course, absolutely.
Because I two of my most wonderful years were the 2 years I spent at Curtis, and I was accepted by Bohuslav Martinu to study composition. He brought me to America together with Aaron Copland, who suggested it to him. But by the time I arrived at Curtis, he had left, and I had a great teacher, Vittorio Giannini. But I never met Martinu.
He was my teacher at Juilliard.
Really?
Giannini, yes, my first year at Juilliard. Yes,
wonderful man.
Yes.
We became very close friends. Anyway, I went to see my violin teacher, Efren Zimbalist, who was the head of Curtis, to say, you know, I'm happy to be here. I'm delighted to be studying composition. But my main interest at the moment really is conducting. And what he told me is a very interesting comment, which should be written in stone. He said, you know, conducting cannot be studied or learned. Conductors are either born or not. He said, look at the great conductors of the day. He mentioned Toscanini, who had been dead for 20 years. He never studied conducting. He mentioned Stokowski, who later on became my friend and mentor.
Yes.
He said he never studied conducting. Pierre Monteux, Fritz Reiner, and went on and on with his fantastic list. None of those people studied conducting. So you really have to learn music. Conducting will come up. Well, I said, well, in that case, I want to graduate as soon as possible so I can pursue. He said, yes, you can do that. Only one other person has graduated in 2 years, he said, was Leonard Bernstein. You can do the same if you complete your assignments, your prerequisites, which was a symphony, a piano sonata, string quartet. I did them very quickly, and I graduated in 2 years. And I went to Minneapolis to study conducting with Antal Dorati, my first teacher and mentor.
Wonderful.
But there's an interesting concept. What he said was true, but on the other hand, it's a lengthy process to become a conductor. When Stokowski played my first symphony, while I was still a student at Curtis, you know, he couldn't play the Ives Fourth Symphony in Houston, Texas. The orchestra couldn't do it in those days.
I had read about that. They said it was unplayable.
It was unplayable. So one of the cellists in the orchestra showed him the score of my first symphony. Who is this person? Stokowski asked. And the cellist, his name was Harvey Wolf, said, he's a student at Curtis, he's 17, and this is his first symphony. So Stokowski opened the score very quickly. We'll do this in place of the Ives Fourth. So when I went to Houston, my first and only question to Stokowski was, I would like to be a conductor, maestro. Do you have an advice? Very naive of me. Backstage, he said, yes, I have an advice. Very interesting. He said, go around the world and watch all the bad conductors and learn what not to do.
Uh-huh.
It was his tongue-in-cheek British humor coming out.
Of course.
And he was right. One can learn from other people's mistakes.
Yes.
But I learned mostly, really, from watching him all the 5 years I worked with him, watching Pierre Monteux, who became my teacher as well,
wonderful.
Dorati, and then Zell in Cleveland for 2 years. So it's a combination of both.
So you are happy with what you are now. You are a premier conductor and incidentally a composer, right?
Well, both. But I'm learning something new every day, and I learn from other people's music all the time. And right now I'm learning the Dvorak, which is my
this is what you're doing now, the Dvorak, the whole series, is that right?
Correct. It's a Dvorak cycle. I'm about to go back to England to record the Eighth Symphony, which is one of my favorites, and the Legends, which are very beautiful.
Gorgeous.
But
those are so
my latest record, latest Dvorak volume number 4, I think it is, just came out. I think it came out
the fourth.
Today. The Second Symphony, which is one of the most beautiful and almost completely unknown.
So, I mean, just quickly, what made you go back to Dvorak?
It was a request of the orchestra, the Bournemouth Symphony. The members of the orchestra and the board and the directors came to see me in my apartment in London and said, we made so many records with you of William Schumann, Ned Roram, and other American composers. We also recorded the complete Stokowski orchestrations, Bach, Mussorgsky, right, and so on and so forth. How about recording something classic romantic to show the orchestra's ability to compete with any orchestra in the world, like Dvorak? And I said, great idea. Let's do. I talked to Warner Classics. They loved the idea because they didn't have a complete Dvorak cycle. And it was a marriage made in heaven. It's worked beautifully.
Did you learn anything new about his music?
I've recorded twice the symphony number 8 and 9, but I had never recorded the numbers 1 through 7. So, of course, I learned enormously. I learned the most interesting thing I learned is how Dvorak simplified his idiom going from symphony to symphony, which is amazing because, let's say, Beethoven made his music much more complicated as he went along. Mm-hmm. The string quartets, the late string quartets, are incredibly complicated. Dvorak took the opposite path. As he began to observe the audience reaction to his works, as he began to hear his works, because the first symphonies he never heard, he only heard the second symphony, I think, several decades after he wrote it, so he couldn't learn from that experience. So as he progressed, he made his music clearer and simpler. And that's a great lesson to me.
Yes, well, I think he learned a lot. I mean, he was really, I think he was very courageous. You know, he came to New York and he came here to the States and then he went back home, basically.
Yes.
I think what happened with him.
So,
there's so much to talk to you about, Maestro, but I do appreciate your giving us this rare, rare interview. And when will you be coming back to Philadelphia? Will you be conducting here at all?
As soon as possible.
I'm going to quote you on that, okay? And thank you so very, very much. It's been a delight.
My pleasure. Wonderful to speak to you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. All the best.
For a second listen to selected crossover interviews, visit WRTI.org. Crossover was produced by Jill Pasternak in the studios of WRTI Philadelphia for the WRTI Radio Network. This is Joe Hattie, Crossover's technical producer. Crossover is syndicated nationally by Global Media Group Incorporated. Thanks for listening.